All right. Just welcome. Hey, I'm going to start that over. All right. Okay. Well, welcome to the Erie Music History Podcast. I'm Chip Shell, your host. And my guest today may not be a musician, but back in the day, he took some piano lessons and violin when he was younger. But despite that, he did have what I'd call a transformative effect on the Erie music scene for about 31 years. Of course, that effect came primarily through the words that he wrote in the Erie newspaper about Erie musicians and bands, but it also came from his unwavering support of the live music scene as his alter ego, Dr. Rock. So it's my pleasure to welcome Dave Richards to the podcast.
Thanks for remembering me.
Oh, come on. Everybody remembers you. Yeah, for sure. I mean, your words live on in all the paper and everything. And these days, you've been retired since 2018?
Or 2016, actually.
Oh, yeah. 2016. Okay.
Yes. I freelanced for about 3 years after that, you know, contributed.
Right.
You know, I had 1 month full retirement when they called and begged me to please continue writing on local music.
Yeah.
Because they had nobody else to do it at the time. So
right.
I continued to write at least on that, but other times features as well.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So let me run through a few quick bullet points to go over a lot of the background of you so we can get to that good stuff of you talking about the Erie music scene and back when you came here. So you grew up in Waukegan, Illinois. Went to the University of Illinois,
yes.
Journalism. 1984, you come to Erie from the Chicago area to cover sports and music for the evening paper of the Erie Times News, right?
Right, and for a Showcase, which was in both papers.
Yeah, so that was a great opportunity, sports and music, sports and entertainment. Your old co-worker and the late, great Pat Howard said of you, you're prolific as a writer, you're pace and passion go unmatched. You were writing, like I said, sports and entertainment. You were cranking stuff out all the time. Of course, to do that, you attended hundreds of national and local music events. You attended Live Aid in 1985. You convinced the paper to send you there. I've heard that story. You interviewed hundreds of famous musicians, like you just mentioned earlier, including Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And of course, there's the famous story of when Ozzy called you at home. we sure. can get to that. You love alternative music, however that's defined. You're a big Clash fan. You're a Cubs fan. Still.
Everybody has tragedy in
their
lives.
Yeah, right. So let's go back. 1984, you come to Erie. You're working at the Times. And 2 days later, you do what you like to do. And you go out and you see a live band. And you go to Norb's.
Right.
So Norb's, for those of you who aren't listening, and I can't imagine there are a lot of folks that listen to this podcast who don't know about Norb's, but I always like to mention it. Norb's was the typical Erie corner bar, 25th and Peach, owned, of course, by Norb Krasinski's, were the boys who were in the Bedrocks that night playing, right?
Yes. 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 When I had arrived in Erie, you know, I was hired by Kevin Cuneo.
Okay.
And his younger brother is Jimmy Cuneo.
Right.
Musician back then and forever. You know, he's a quintessential Erie musician.
Been on the podcast, and you say quintessential better than me. That's good. Yeah.
And one of the first things I asked him when I got to Erie was, like, so where do you go for local original music? You know, I want to hear some. He said, well, go to Norb's. And I said, well, when? He goes, well, every Friday. Every Friday night, they have original bands. And he explained that the Bedrocks were the house band.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I did. That very Friday, went off to Norb's and caught the Bedrocks. And they just blew me away. I just absolutely loved it. You know, number one, their covers that they did were all songs I loved. You know, they're doing The Police and The Cult and bands like that.
Yeah.
But it was also that, you know, Tony just wrote original, contagious, infectious.
Indeed.
And highly, you know, melodic original tunes that also rocked. And his brother Dave was excellent on the guitar. So yep. They just won me over from the start. And
yeah.
I was like, whoa, I guess I made the right move here.
How was the vibe when you walked in there? Because, I mean, Tony's been on the podcast before. I mean, of course, his dad owns the place. But still, I mean, people talked about it. I mean, I've been there plenty of times, too. I mean, it's a small place. The stage was in the corner. It's a small stage. I mean, that vibe in that place for original music had to have been exactly what you were looking for.
Oh, it was. It felt like, you know, the epicenter of cool, you know. all the cool people were assembled there.
Yeah.
And Erie's a small town, and that bar was even smaller, so.
Yeah.
Probably all the cool people in Erie at the time, they were all in Norbs at the same,
right.
the same time.
And the Bedrocks were a three-piece band, we should tell folks. I mean, and they created a lot of original music. I always remember seeing them when they opened for the Stabilizers at the Avalon Hotel, or what, maybe it was.
I helped set that up.
Did you help set that up?
I did, actually. They
tell us about that.
Well, at the time, the manager, I think it was his name, Tom Zutat. I don't know if I'm remembering that or not. But anyway, the guy that who had signed the Stabilizers,
yeah,
they had set up a big show for them in Erie down at the Avalon.
Yeah.
To play as a part of their whole CD release thing. They were trying to find like an opening act. And so I pushed for the Bedrocks because they play original music too.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they were one of my favorite Erie bands at the time. So
yeah,
it ended up happening.
That's so cool. So Norbs obviously became a regular stop for you. Where else back then? I mean, I always ask folks, you know, favorite bars back in the day, because there's so many of them that aren't around anymore. I mean, were you going to the Beer Mug and Sherlock's and Goofy's and all those regular haunts? Or
yes.
Yeah.
All the above.
Yeah.
Of course, the original Dock Cider.
Right.
That was the other place that I truly loved. And, of course, it couldn't be more different musically.
You
know, there was all about blues and early on, you know, Grateful Dead kind of bands. And before the jam band name was even around, I mean, that's what they kind of had down there.
You right.
know? But especially blues and folk. And he brought in some, you know, top-notch national talent. But, you know, you also had Zipper City Blues Band with Roger Montgomery and
right.
Later Big Dave and the Ultrasonics and, you know, good groups like that.
Yep.
And again, the vibe there was, you know, just everything.
It
you
was.
Know, it just was so relaxed and cool, easygoing. And a lot of times, though, it was wall-to-wall in there. It was a long, skinny bar, not sure. room for a lot of people. But it was... It was great. You know, sometimes you just, you know, you don't realize what you're, when you're going through it, how great things are until, you know, like Joan Mitchell said, you know.
About,
yeah, so.
And you're in your early 20s?
When back you then. Back I was 27 when I moved to Erie.
Okay. And so how was Erie as far as welcoming someone new? You know, I mean, you went to these places and, you know, I've heard you say on some of the other podcasts, like we talked about, you've been on Tyler Smiler's podcast, you've been on Jack Stevenson and Nat the Hats. I mean, back then, you really didn't know a lot of people. Or did you know anybody?
No, didn't know anybody when I moved to Erie.
Okay.
Not a soul. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah.
I was hired out of an ad that the Times had put in Editor and Publisher magazine, which was the trade magazine for journalism back there.
Right.
I don't know how much of this part you want to hear, but
right.
at the time I was working for, you know, a pretty lousy twice a week paper that ran in the suburbs of Chicago,
okay.
Chicago Heights and Oak Forest, those communities. And I did sports there primarily, but I wanted to expand my horizon. So I begged them to write a music column and they were like, sure, go ahead if you want to. And that's where Dr. Rock was born, was in that place, actually.
Okay.
That's
right.
Where I came up with it and wrote music reviews and occasional features and other things like movies. And so when a friend of mine who arrived there after I did, but then found a job within a year with a major daily,
yeah.
I was jealous. I was like, oh my God, what am I doing here for 3 years? I should yeah. be out there. So the minute he told me they got hired, I was jealous. And I grabbed editor and publisher and said, okay, let me see what's out there. And then I saw an ad for this paper in Erie looking for somebody who could write sports, but entertainment too.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, geez, that's, if anything was ever up my alley, this is it.
Right, you know? Right.
So I sent in clips of Dr. Rock columns I had done and, of course, sports clips as well. And eventually I got hired. And then I found out later that, you know, Showcase had been created only a year or two before I moved here. And
right.
and Kevin and Doug Reeder, who was the editor of Showcase,
right.
were, you know, looking for another writer, but the paper had never hired outside of Erie before.
Oh.
I was the test case for them. They put an ad in a national magazine and did a national search. And
And they got you.
Well, and luckily it worked out for them, because then they continued to use that approach. And, you know, and the paper made some terrific hires after that, and just, you know, got better and better.
Well, I know guys, I know Doug Reeder. He actually works for us here as a part-time proofer. And I obviously know his wife, Sherry, and, you know, they're very music-oriented people. I mentioned Pat Howard. You know, a lot of those folks have told me the stories over the years of how you would make mixtapes or mix CDs, you know, because you were super influential on your coworkers also. But going back to my original question of, so aside from those people at work, you didn't know anybody in Erie. So were you welcomed as, like when you went to Norb's, like, hey, I don't know anybody, you know, people weren't hanging out with you because you were Dr. Rock, I imagine. I mean, you just got to know people that way, or...
Right. I didn't start Dr. Rock in Erie until July, I think it was, of that year.
Okay.
And I wrote a couple months first and then kind of said, hey, I had done this other Dr. Rock column and I'd love to keep doing music reviews. And at the time, we thought it would be kind of funny if it just wasn't under my real name.
Yeah.
You know? So I was, let's continue as Dr. Rock, but not have a byline on there so people wouldn't know who it was. But I was funny. I thought it was funny, though, like Dave Richards is DR and Dr. Rock is DR.
Yeah.
But even Doug Reeder was
Doug Reeder, DR. Sure, right. Yeah.
So nobody could be sure who it was.
How long did that go on that you were anonymous as Dr. Rock?
Oh, it went on for a long time. I mean, I think people figured it out.
And
people kind of knew.
Okay, right.
But later on we started the Rock Erie Music Awards, and
sure.
I would show up as Dr. Rock. So
gotcha. All right. So,
as your other question, I felt like I fit in pretty well,
you know,
because I loved the music so much and made friends pretty quickly. I think, you know, obviously I befriended the Bedrocks, you know, Tony Krasinski. In fact, later he invited me to his wedding, which I went to.
Okay.
So, you know, that was cool to do.
Yeah.
And I ended up becoming friends with the people in the bands that I personally liked the most and hung out with, like later the Dogs,
right,
when I got to know them. I felt like I fit in pretty well early on.
And that alternative scene, you know, the Dogs, the Bedrocks, those are sort of popular bands from that era, the early 80s. We've had Tom Weber on, we've had Tony on, we've had Bob Nelson on from the Docksider, you know, right, talking about all those different things. Who were some of those other bands back then that really hit you? I know that you love the Dogs and the Bedrocks, but who else back then that folks may not remember?
Well, all the names won't come to mind like they should right off the bat.
That's
but,
right.
You know, usually anything Rick DiBello was involved in was worth listening to because, again, local songwriter and did original music.
And he was always involved in a lot.
He was. And same with Jimmy Cuneo. Out of all his projects, Bagoon, I think, was one of the ones I liked the most. They were awesome.
Yeah.
Later on, there was a band, Pegasus Unicorn, that wrote original music that I thought was terrific.
Yeah.
And, of course, Roger Montgomery Blues Band, I love them as well. And Plato's Cave came along. They were the first real monster jam band in Erie.
I mean,
just blew up completely. And near the end, every Docksider gig was just jammed. And, oh, my God, they were just so much fun.
And Blind Dog was a precursor to that.
Blind Dog.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah.
Like I say, the Shrugs was another one that Tony was in later.
Yeah.
Garage Rock, which I kind of liked as well. And Generic Beat. You know, they were a riot as well. The X-Whites, remember them? I remember some crazy X-Whites gigs with Danny taking his clothes off, the lead singer, and performing and just
doing
crazy things.
Right, right.
So,
yeah. Were there some back then, you know, obviously you leaned more towards the alternative original bands, all these bands that we talked about. There aren't a lot of covers being played. You weren't going out to see Friction or, you know, regular cover bands. And I know that you wrote about those original bands at first because that was your love. Did it switch after a while? I know Dr. Rock started writing more about cover bands. Why was it?
Well, there were a few reasons. I mean, you know, when I first started, you know, I was young and I was like a musical snob. And I thought, you know, you learn as you grow older.
Right.
You know what I mean? It dawned on me, geez, these people who play in cover bands obviously have musical talent if they can play all these other groups' songs. That's
right.
A whole different kind of a talent maybe than songwriting, but it's a talent nonetheless. And they also draw huge crowds. And people probably want to know more about these groups just as much as the original groups do as well. So I changed my mind after a few years and just decided, you know, they were equally worthy to write about, and I should be doing that.
Right. Were there cover bands you went to see?
You know, back then, not as much.
Yeah.
Really, not as much. But you know, even today, though, I go to plenty of them, you know, the Breeze Band, the Groove, you know, a lot of those bands. The current one, Northern Accents, that do Tom Petty, they do a great job with that. I enjoy seeing them.
Yeah.
So, I have no trouble seeing, like, cover bands now. It's become so accepted. I mean, I'm so old. I mean, I remember, like, even when tribute bands first came to Erie, it was like, controversial. What? A band coming out playing all Led Zeppelin? Who do they think they are, you know? And you're trying to dress up like them? It was like, you know, I thought it was an abomination. Like, this can't be. And,
right.
You know, and now we live in an age where you pay $75 or to see a cover band at the Warner Theater, you know, doing all Beatles or Zeppelin or Pink Floyd or whatever.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. And back then people were like, and $10 to see that? That's ridiculous. What about as you're reporting and writing about these bands, first of all, how did you choose some of them? Was it just, I like these guys, or someone would tell you about them? Was it always, like, say, the original bands, when you first came to town, because you didn't know anybody? I mean, was it just that? Like, basically, I went to this show, and this is what I heard.
At first, that's how it would start. I'd go check out a band, and if I liked them, I'd come up and tell them, hey, I'd like to write a feature about you guys. And then it was also based on, I mean, who was going to be playing out that weekend. You know, the kind of the mantra of Showcase was, here's the best of what's going on today, Thursday, through the following Wednesday.
Yeah.
So if I was going to write about a band, they had to be playing out within that 6-day period.
Right.
You know, so that that determined a lot as well.
And you use the word feature, so I'm familiar with that term, but then there's also an op-ed or an opinion piece too. And so, or a review in this case for the Times. Like, those were two different things, right?
Right. And yeah, I would review, like, local albums and CDs quite a bit. You know, where, again, that's the whole point of a review, is to give your opinion. But in the features, you know, you try to not do that. That's let them speak, you know.
Right.
Let them explain what they're about and why.
Stick
you know
to
what
the
I
facts.
Mean? You know, stick with the facts. I mean, I would try to describe their music, and so anybody reading it might say, oh, wow, that sounds like something I might like. And then would go check it out.
Yeah.
I mean, from the start, for me, it's always been about just trying to turn people onto live music and music in general. So that was always my mission. So I always felt original bands had it harder in that respect. I mean, people tend to gravitate to things they know. It's just human nature. So building audiences for original music, I always thought was especially challenging. So if I could describe them in a way musically that made it sound like, you know, oh, they're a cross between this and this, you know.
Yeah.
Artists hate that. Bands hate that. They don't like that at all. But readers love that because it gives them a ballpark of, like, okay, what they might sound like.
Right. You know?
So,
were there ever any instances where a band or musicians were upset with what you had written about them?
To tell you the truth, not really. I would get hate mail for, you know, reviews of albums as Dr. Rock, you know, because again, when I was young, I intentionally would just bash, like, you know, Duran and things like that.
Oh, okay. So
things I didn't like, but I would write a review of something, and I would just get volumes of hate mail.
Really?
When I wrote about Duran, I used to call him Simon Le Bon Bomb or Simon Le Bomb. I would intentionally get his last name wrong just to be sort of insulting. And then these teenagers would write in these impassioned letters, you don't even know his real last name. And, and it was funny. And some were threatening letters too. I mean, some were, like, you know, anonymously written, was very, you know, threatening.
Really?
People took the music very seriously. This is, again, before the age of the internet and everything. So, you know, I would get actual letters.
Physical
in the mail.
Letters, right.
People took the time to write them out and send them to you.
People show up ever?
No, no, they only showed up when we had contests, and they were there to collect their prize.
Oh, okay. Nobody.
I used to do, like, a trivia question
right.
A bunch of weeks. Yeah, and the person would show up to collect their album, and, you know, they were usually happy that they were getting something free.
How about when you're out seeing bands? I mean, any drunks come up to you afterwards, you know, you said this or that or no? Or
you know, I would hear through the grapevine that so-and-so hates you or so-and-so, you know. I seem to develop a reputation for being an asshole, I guess.
Oh, really?
And I was never quite sure why. I never thought I acted like that. I just think people made assumptions.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Right.
They saw me as, quote, the expert who is the ultimate arbiter of taste of music in Erie and,
right,
you know, didn't like me because of that.
Sure.
And so, yeah, there were times. And one guy, I think, maybe it's best not to say his name because I like him now and he's a friend. And actually, I mean, I do like his music, but he actually wrote a song blasting Dr. Rock by name in the song.
Oh, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how much that guy hated me way back when.
But were there bands, local bands, that would send you a press kit or tapes? You know, hey, we want you to listen to this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They would drop things off or they would call and say, can you write about us?
But oh, really?
Okay. I refused to like write about groups unless I had either seen them or heard them.
Yeah.
I had to, you know, I had to have some context here, you know, just to make sure to, you know, you also want to make sure they're at a certain level. You don't want to be recommending something and then people go there and say, what?
That's a good point.
They were tuneless.
Yeah.
They,
right.
They didn't know how to play their instruments. What do you do? You know? So
did you ever save any of those old tapes or anything like that? Or
I've got a billion, cassette tapes and CDs from local bands. I mean, just volumes of them. Some of them I've donated to the library when they were doing a big local music thing. They were trying to put them in circulation so people could check them out and stuff. So after I retired, I did bring them quite a few boxes. And I should probably bring more because, again, they're just sitting there taking up space in my house. One CD I have is one probably nobody has, and that's Pat Monahan lived in Erie, and for a long time, everybody knows he grew up here. But
sure.
When he woke up with that song, Drops of Jupiter, in his head, he said it just occurred to him. And he called up Trevor Huster, who back then was, you know, working a studio. And he said, Trevor, I got to get this song down. And, you know, he went over there, and they worked out, like, the framework for how they wanted to do Drops of Jupiter. And I have, like, the demo of that on CD. Somewhere.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it lately, but I know it's somewhere. I've got it somewhere.
And that's, you know, obviously before Train, was he in Rose Gallery at the time?
No, he was already in Train at the time.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, he would come back to Erie quite often back then and show up. I've got a photo of him, actually, with Randy Hetherington, who was the...
I know Randy. He ran in a band with him.
Back then, he was in the Forward Hall as the engineer.
Yep.
And that's where we were at the recording part of...
I've been there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's with also with, believe it or not, what's the guy's name? Oh, Brendan O'Brien.
Right.
You know, he's produced Pearl Jam. But he also had worked with Train. I'm pretty sure that's him. Yeah. It's his old little Polaroid photo of the Randy and Pat and them together.
Did you, Pat, you know, was he obviously played in Rogues Gallery and who else? Where else?
Boy, you know, his early bands were all cover bands, and that was back during the period when I wasn't super big on going to see cover bands.
That's what I wondered, yeah.
And so Train was really the first I've heard of him.
Interesting.
And that was through his dad. His dad stopped into the Showcase office one day and said, my son Pat Monahan from Erie, you know, he went out to San Francisco, and they just recorded a CD, and this is before they had signed a Columbia. They had signed with a smaller label called Aware, and nobody was aware of them at the time, but his dad was super proud of it.
He said,
so would you write about him? I'm like, well, are they playing in Erie? And he said, well, no, but they are playing in Pittsburgh, and he's a local guy. And I said, well, okay, whatever, thanks, I'll listen to it. And it blew me away. I don't know, have you heard Train's first album?
Sure, did it have Meet Virginia on it?
Yes, and it was a real, you know, Americana.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It was basically Americana before the term came in.
Right.
And I really, really liked it.
Right.
So I set up an interview with Pat and did a nice feature that ran to highlight their Pittsburgh show.
Oh, okay. All right.
And Pat told me like years later that at the time it was a rough period for the band. They were just struggling and that the article meant lot to them.
Yeah.
So I was kind of surprised by that. But of course, later on, you know, Bev brought them in. I think they played Sherlock's twice, you know, and you know, same thing, wrote about them then. But it was Pat's dad that actually
got
that whole thing.
And when they played at Sherlock's, that was still in the early days.
Oh, yeah, still relatively early.
Yeah.
And, but, yeah, they were terrific.
Hmm. Did you end up connecting with him as he went on, like when he would come back and play Erie Insurance or anything like that?
Oh,
or,
yeah. Every time he came to Erie, I would, you know, dutifully write another train story try to find a new, some kind of a new angle, you know, usually centered around whatever the new album was. I mean, the last time was when he came in here to promote their wine label, believe it or not.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And there was another time he, he actually sent me the demo of Hey Soul Sister, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
He said, what do you think of this? Do you think it's... I remember thinking, oh, it sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah.
I was convinced that, it was a good song. And, of course, it arguably became their biggest song ever.
Right.
You know, so...
Interesting. Were there other bands like that that... Well, not like that, because you didn't really go see Rogues Gallery. And I keep using that term, or that band, to, you know, as the one that he was in. I'm sure he was in some other ones, but were there bands, I'm sure, like the Dogs, that were cranking out original music that you thought, these guys, they should go farther than this? You know, I think they're going to go farther.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've always thought, like, Erie has just far more talent than a lot of larger cities have. That's what always blew me away here about the music scene. Of course, I loved alternative, we had that, but there was a thriving punk and underground scene here for years too, you know, the Hangout at Continental Ballroom, where those bands, you know, My Three Scum, they were huge in Erie for a long time. I mean, huge for an underground kind of a punk band.
Right.
And they were instrumental in bringing a lot of that to the city as well, that you had all the blues musicians in Erie that were out and playing at Docksider.
Sure.
It was, you know, just unbelievable, the amount of talent, but the diversity of talent too, for the different genres. I mean, we had a lot of that going on in Erie. And, yeah, I was always, you know, who knows why some bands get signed and why others don't. I always thought the Bedrock songs were good enough to, believe me, I've heard far worse.
Yeah, I bet.
And then that sounds bad, because they were really, really good.
Yeah.
And who knows why it doesn't happen. Same with the Dogs. I mean, the Dogs just had some amazing songs, you know.
Yeah.
And who knows why some catch on and others don't. The first one was, even before Train, was the Stabilizers. Do you remember them?
Sure. Yep. Yeah. You like know? I said, I was there that night that, you know, the Bedrock's opened for them at the Avalon and everything. And so,
funny story with them is I had just moved to Erie in 84. And at the time, I lived in an apartment on West 10th Street, because I didn't know where to go. And I wanted to be close enough to walk to work if I had to.
Sure.
And I had my first party there on West 10th. And, Rich Nevins and Dave Christensen, I must have met previously. I don't remember how, but they came to the party.
And they were the Stabilizers,
yeah,
for those of you who
don't know. They were the Stabilizers, and they were just getting started.
Right.
And I think it was Rich. He pulled out a cassette tape and said, hey, can we play this? And I said, well, yeah, 'cause we recorded, you know, a couple songs. And I said, why not? So, like, we put them on at the party.
Yeah.
And these were, like, Tyranny and...
One Simple Thing.
And One Simple Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they played them at the party, you know. And I cut to a few years later, they're getting signed by Columbia Records and airplay on Star 104.
Right. MTV.
You know, people forget, like, back then, too. You know, Erie Radio at one point did support local bands. They used to play songs by Friction and Stabilizers, you know.
Absolutely.
Way before corporate radio just completely took over the universe, you know. And
that
just simply doesn't happen anymore usually, so...
That's interesting. So the Stabilizers at that point were super early, and granted, they didn't really play out a lot prior to making it big. They recorded that stuff. Rich Nevins was from England, I think.
Right.
Dave Christensen, rest his soul, was an Erie guy.
Right.
And they had gotten together, and then for that gig at the Avalon, which was kind of a... For studio folks, or what was it? To announce their...
It was a CD album release show.
Basically,
basically. It's what I remember it. Right. It's what I vaguely remember it from. That was a party. You know, well, unbelievable what was going on at that party. It was the 80s, let's just say that.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah. We can say anything on this podcast.
Let's say I don't remember much from that party, okay? I remember it happened, and I remember how crazy crowded it was.
Right.
But even before that, I think Stabilizers had headlined a Celebrate Erie or a We Love Erie State Night once.
Maybe,
I remember they had done that.
Yeah.
But they were not like one of these Erie groups, though, that played out every weekend. They weren't weekend warriors by any means.
No, nope. They played the PI, I know, and, you know, maybe Sherlock's or stuff like that. But there weren't a lot leading up to that.
Radio really helped them, the airplay, just get them the huge following, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and it worked. I mean, One Simple Thing did become a hit, you know, and it got airplay on MTV.
Right.
And then Columbia dropped them before they could even release their second album.
Right.
That's another rare thing I have. I have that second album because they had pressed some copies, but then they dropped them. And I think they later re-recorded it. I think they had to buy back their own songs, if I'm remembering this right.
Wow.
Right. My brain's a little foggy at this point. That's remembering all this stuff.
Yeah.
But
did you stay in touch with Dave at all, or... Or Rich?
I did for a little bit after they left Erie. But then, you know, after they broke up.
Right.
You know, the paper asked me for some reason, after I had retired, to do some 30th anniversary of the Stabilizers story.
Yeah.
So I went back and got a hold of both of them. One was in California, and Rich was, can't remember. Was he in Washington? Mm. Not D.C., I mean Washington State or Oregon. I can't remember. But I got a hold of both of them. Interviewed them, and
they both worked in the music industry, just
right,
right. Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes and production or whatever. Right. So, so I did a big story on them then, and Dave, even when I did the interview with him, I think he confided in me that he was ill at the time.
Oh, really?
But begged me, please don't put it in the story. And so I honored his wishes. Of course, didn't put it in there. But when he died, not long after that, I kind of knew it.
Yeah.
It was coming. It's just so sad.
It was sad, yeah. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and those guys had it, I mean, stage presence. We always hear about stage presence, right? And, you know, you said that Erie has this diverse type of genres, right? I mean, you went to see everything from punk to blues to whatever alternative. You mentioned Danny Smith of the X-Whites, you know.
Right.
That's a guy that oozed stage presence, you know. And that oftentimes, as a musician, that's what makes you connect with the audience, right? I mean, and you had to have seen plenty of those folks over the years, you know, that had that stage presence. Maybe they weren't the greatest, you know, musician, but they really grasped you. Like, who were some of those folks over the years that you loved seeing?
Bruce Lenz from the Dogs, I always thought had a lot of
absolutely
a lot of charisma.
Yeah,
you know, he was a very smart, sarcastic kind of guy too, with a great sense of humor, and that was reflected in their material as well. So I always thought Bruce was a really good front man.
Sure.
Oh boy, you're gonna put me on the spot.
I know.
Here, but as far as performers go, let me think here.
One World Tribe, Preach.
Yeah, I mean, Preach.
Yeah,
Preach and One World Tribe, definitely. He just has a magnetism and a charisma. Yeah. He's commanding up there. You know, you can't take your eyes off him. So One World Tribe is another group that, you know, they did have a good deal of success. They headlined festivals in the East Coast and Buffalo a lot of times. I don't think they were quite as appreciated in their hometown as they could have been, to tell you the truth. But, They're another one. Jake's Blues, Jake Banna. You know, he and I differ on opinions on a lot of things these days, but I have to say back in the day when he was, you know, he could play Eight Great Tuesdays and fill up the whole amphitheater.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, even back when he was playing Sherlock's and he was jumping on tables and bars and things like that, he was young. I mean, that was unheard of. You know, Roger Montgomery wasn't doing that, but Roger Montgomery grasped your attention in different ways, you know. Guys like Jake were running around and, you know, having fun. And, I mean, it just depends on how we define that term, right? Stage presence and charisma, like you said.
And they didn't play in the area very long, but there was a band called Mas Nova. Do you remember them?
Yeah. Wasn't Trevor in that band?
Trevor was in that band. And their lead singer had a fantastic voice, Joe Newcomer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they wrote some great songs. Their first CD was, like, tremendous.
Yeah.
And, again, they're another one I thought, where they're going to go places, or they should go places. You know, they definitely had the talent to.
Right.
And, again, Erie, we're not exactly located next to Los Angeles or New York, you know. Music right. people were not coming out here to discover people.
Right.
Way back when it used to work that if a local radio station put in a local band in rotation, they all reported their playlists to the trades. And so music companies would see, wait, who's this group getting airplay in this city? What? And they would check some of them out based on that.
You know? Okay.
And that's how, like, sometimes local people would break through.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened with Stabilizers, you know. Star 104 was reporting the heavy airplay that they were getting, and somebody in California got wise and said, well, let's go check them out, and heard their music. And, you know, they were, you know, the height of the synth pop days in the 80s. They fit right into that, so...
It's interesting, you know, I interview a lot of guys and gals from the 60s and 70s before you came to Erie, you know, when it was even more different, you know, there was that relationship with the radio station or the DJs, you know, you walked over and you handed them your 45 that you had, pressed and everything. And there was way more, you know, back then playing local music. And there were other opportunities, you know, there were more places to play at a bigger venue, you know, whether it be Rainbow Gardens or the Erie Arts and Arts Festival, some arts festival, Erie Days, whatever it was prior to that. What were you going to add on?
Oh, and I was going to say, like, somebody told me, like, Sherlock's at one point used to have music like 5 nights a week.
Right.
And they,
right.
And they could support that. There exactly. was like the hunger and the
yep.
for it. Those days are gone.
a lot of the...
And so is Sherlock's.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the folks that I interview talk about playing 6 or 7 days a week, 10 to 12. You know, if you played at, you know, after-hours clubs like the Calabrese Club, you played till 4 a.m. And I always ask that same question. Were there people there on a Wednesday night till 4 a.m.? And the answer is yes, there were. You know, it was a different time, you know. But, I mean, it obviously is a different scene. And when you came in 84, I think it was a pivotal time for Erie. Like you mentioned all those different genres, just like in rock and roll and MTV had just come out. There was just all this melding of these different types of music, right? I mean, and how did that, I don't know, what's the bigger question I'm asking here? You know, for you, it was just, this is just the scene now, right? There were all these different types of music, but it eventually evolves to where we are today, you know, and even near the end of your tenure at the paper, like how did you see the scene changing over the years? Not just from the disappearance of the venues, although I'm sure that had an effect, but.
Well, definitely, you know, cover bands took over, you know, the scene. I mean, original bands could hold their own for a while. And I really do think it became more about the jukebox bands and the cover bands after a while, you know. Bar owners would pay whoever drew, you know, it's generally the way it worked. And so if cover bands were starting to pack them in, then more of them would do that. Also, I think at some point, you know, the summer music scene just really exploded, and everywhere you could hear live music in the summer. And I remember I started compiling a guide because it was just so crazy. You know, I was like, you know, here's... Anyway, I think in a strange way, overall, that's kind of hurt the scene because people just got so used to, like, I can see music anywhere, whenever I want to, and it made it less of an event, you know.
Interesting.
I think some bands burn themselves out also by paying out too often.
Right.
And so their crowds would slowly diminish, you know.
Yeah.
It should, you know, instead of playing maybe once every couple months, they play it out every other week or something, or every week.
Right.
Eventually the crowds go down. I mean, that happened to Bedrocks, you know, and they had their home bar at Norbs, and they played there virtually every week. I mean, there were other bands that played too, but when you knew they were always going to be there, you didn't always have to go at the at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, cover bands took over a lot. The changing in venues, like you said, so many places are gone now, you know.
Right.
You know, Bear Mug's gone, Sherlock's is gone, Bobby's Place. You know, Crooked Eye, Forward Hall,
yep,
Docksider,
Oliver's,
Continental Ballroom was another place.
Continental Ballroom, that's one that I always forget about. Yeah, and that was one of the questions I was going to have is, you know,
Goofies,
yeah, and a lot of those places catered to original bands. You're right, and I always say this today is, in today's scene, I feel bad for full bands because there is not an opportunity, as many opportunities for places to play in a full band scenario, or hard rock, you know, heavy metal, or originals. I mean, that's tough, but I'm seeing more and more places, you know, Philly on the Rocks, you know, catering to original bands and stuff like that. And hopefully, you know, it'll balance out.
It also seemed to me that, you know, my generation especially, we, you know, music was such an important, integral part of your life. I mean, music mattered and it was important to you growing up. I don't think that's the case as much anymore.
Interesting.
Music is just another commodity out there like anything else. And so maybe for younger music fans especially, just that compulsion you have that I've got to go see a band, I don't think that's there anymore. You know?
Yeah. Much less I'm going to go see a band and stay out till 2 a.m. because that band's playing 10 to 2. That's gone by too. You know, I mean, the majority of places close at midnight these days, much less the bands are usually over by 10.
Well, yeah, COVID, I think, had the biggest effect on that.
And, right.
And I still think it's the older audience that still has this taste and hunger for live music, and they don't want to stay up till 2 in the morning to hear a band anymore.
Sure.
I know that's true with me. I go to the 6 to 8 or 7 to 10 shows. I rarely go to the ones that are going to keep me up till 2 in the morning.
Yeah. Being a musician, I can't stand it if I have to play after 9 o'clock. You know, I mean, I'm just so used to 6 to 9, you know. Music festivals, we used to have more. Blues and Jazz Fest, Grape Jam, Blue Heron, Gathering at Chafee's was this past weekend. We are recording this at the end of July, just so folks know, because this probably won't come out until September. You were a festival goer?
I was big into the Blue Heron. I didn't go every year, but I went quite a few years to the Blue Heron.
Tell folks what Blue Heron was.
It's a music fest in Sherman, New York that caters to roots music groups, you know, lots of mandolin and banjos and acoustic guitars and tambourine and that, you know,
yeah.
Not tambourine so much, but, you know, that kind of music. Donna the Buffalo is the perennial headliner.
Right.
And I love that band. I've probably seen that band more than any other group in history.
Okay.
You know?
So, interesting.
But they traditionally headline that every year. And then they bring in, you know, top-notch talent too. The Avett Brothers played there twice.
Oh wow.
Jim Lauderdale has played there. So, you know, they do bring in some other top supporting talent as well. But a lot of times it's the bands you never heard of that blow you away as well.
So that roots music, that surprises me from you. You know, I mean, is that today's alternative music? You know, because is that something else that you just like?
excuse me here. Yeah, you know, as you get older, I mean, you tend to mellow out, I guess, a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I liked, you know, Mumford & Sons when they came out of, you know, Avett Brothers as well.
Right,
But that's not all I listen to. I mean, I still like, I love Portugal the Man. I don't know if you heard of them.
Yep.
I've seen them 4 or 5 times live now. I think they're terrific. I mean, there's still new groups out there I find and like. But, again, you know, if you're really going to get into new music these days, you really have to discover it on your own. I mean, myself, I don't find it through the radio anymore. I have a Spotify.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of times Spotify surprises me. You know, my own playlist will end or something, and it'll start playing other tunes. And I'll be like, wait, who's this? And it'll turn me on to something I hadn't heard before, which is always nice to find.
How did that go back when you started at the paper? Were you just discovering new music at the record store, which we used to have, or...
I read everything, you know.
So
I read the Rolling Stone and magazines and Billboard.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'd always try to stay on top of what was happening in the music scene. If there seemed to be some hot new band out there, I generally was aware of it and would try to like see what it was all about and listen to it.
Yeah. Know? All right.
Especially in the alternative day, the glory days.
Yeah.
Back then, you know.
There were a lot of other options, a lot of zines out there that you could subscribe to or get, and were there some bands that you kind of discovered and then they made it big that you think, oh, I was listening to them?
Oh, yeah, REM was one.
Oh, really?
saw REM. I bought their first 45 on the Hibtone label before they were even signed. Because in Champaign, where I went, we had a very good music scene there and local record shops.
Yeah.
And I remember the guy I used to always talk to at the door selling anything good come in. He's like, oh, you got to hear this song by REM. It was their very first single, Radio for Europe.
Sure, yeah.
He put it on the 45 of it, and I was like, oh, yeah, I like that. I'll take that, you know. And so, of course, who knew then that they would blow up
right.
the way they did. I got on the ground floor with them real early. Hmm. Talking Heads, same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, alternative and punk and all that hit at the right age for me. I was in college.
You right.
know, in the middle of college, working at a stupid pizza joint. And the station they played was the college radio station. And so before I started working at that pizza joint, I was playing, at home, Boston, and, all that kind of stuff.
Well, you were.
That's okay. All I really knew.
Sure,
I didn't know much about
it. Because it was on the radio. Yeah, the regular radio.
The regular radio. Yeah. And then at Papa Del's was the name of the pizza place in Erie, where I was a lowly cook, making $1.60 an hour. The song Psycho Killer came out by Talking Heads. And I was like, what is this? And then another good song, a Roxy music. And I was like, why didn't somebody ever tell me all this music exists? Like, I wish I had known. And I just dove in, head first to that stuff. And The Clash.
Right.
And, that was it. There was no looking back. It did, like I say, made me a music snob. Because then I instantly, said, well, screw you, Boston. And, Styx and all you band. I don't need you anymore. I don't like this shit.
Sure.
So
tell me about being up close and personal at the Stop Making Sense tour for those concerts, because you were a huge Talking Heads fan, right?
Yeah, I loved Talking Heads. For their second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food, they played Champaign.
Okay.
At our, not the big arena, but like a smaller place. And I bought tickets for that. And amazing, that was just the four-piece band then,
right?
Just playing songs off their first two albums, and they were fantastic. And so I loved them because they changed with every album. You didn't know what they were going to do next.
Yeah,
they just kept growing and growing and getting better. So by the time they came out with what turned into be the movie,
right,
Start Making Sense, we didn't know it at the time, but I was such a huge fan that I waited in line for tickets, which you could do back then. Long time ago, you had to buy tickets in person.
At Sears.
Sometimes. And this one was a Sears.
Oh, was it?
I lived across the street then. This is when I was living in Park Forest. It was that in-between time where I was working in Chicago area still.
Yeah.
And waited in line overnight for tickets. I remember there was a full moon that night. And maybe four or five other people showed up to wait in line. Not too many.
Right.
But I was the first one. And get to the window, and the woman says, how many tickets you want? And I'm like, I need four, because I was a couple friends too. She's like, well, how does the first row sound? And again, that doesn't happen anymore.
No, either. No. Yeah, right.
And I was like, sounds good to me. So So we come in, and there we are in our first row, right front, and out comes David Byrne all by himself holding a boombox and an acoustic guitar. We're like, where the hell's the rest of the band? What is going on here?
Yeah.
Again, there was no word of mouth, and I hadn't read about the tour, what they were doing. But, of course, then they built the band up one by one, and that's how the show progressed. And that was one of the rare times I saw a concert, too, where a band did an encore even after the house lights came on.
Oh, wow.
People would not leave. That's how good the show was. And the band was, seemed flustered. So they came back out and were like, well, let's just play Burning Down the House again. So
they did.
They played it a second time.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they had played it during the show. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very rare to see.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Stop Making Sense, my coworker, Ed Macita, who just passed away, he always told me that is the best music film ever made. And I've seen it. I mean, it's fantastic. Even if you're not a Talking Heads fan, like you said, that image of David Byrne coming out there by himself, and that's it on stage. These days you're so used to a giant production, and there wasn't at that point.
course, I had taken a camera, you know, no phones back then.
Yeah.
And I took a camera, and I always kicked myself later because I was just so excited. I just kept taking pictures. And before the big suit thing happened, I was out of film. Oh, no. He comes out in the big suit. I'm like, oh, my God. And I couldn't take any pictures of him.
And you didn't even know that was going to happen.
No.
Didn't know.
He didn't know what he was going to do. But I did get a really nice picture of him that I have hanging in my house of him holding the lamp in that one song.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's
yeah.
kind of like dancing with the lamp. So I got a cool picture of him dancing with the lamp and Tina Weymouth behind him playing the bass.
Very cool.
That's one. I saw them three times, and I've seen Byrne several times, too.
And so we're kind of shifting from the local scene to you as Dr. Rock and national stuff. I mean, you got to go to, like I said, Live Aid. You convinced the folks at the paper, like a year into working there, I need to go to Philadelphia to this thing, right? Well, and
I was like, this is going to be really big,
right.
And we live in Pennsylvania. I should go.
Right,
so,
right.
Would you pick up the cost of the tickets?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've heard the story of you buying the ticket with the one old lady in front of you. You know, she wanted Air Supply, and you're like, I got to get a ticket to Live Aid in 1985. I'm going to go to Philadelphia. For those of you who don't remember, Live Aid was simulcast, right?
It was going on. London concert was going on at the same time.
Wembley, right?
Right. And at Philly, they would occasionally just show you highlights from England, you know, what was going on.
Right.
It was like 90 degrees that day and like 90,000 people there. You didn't even want to move because it was just so hot. Any kind of movement made you sweat and feel all uncomfortable. Well,
how much did tickets cost? Do you remember?
$35.
That was a lot back then. 85.
Yeah, it was a lot. But and it did. But I was like, I've got to go to this.
Yeah.
And my reason was I wanted to see Led Zeppelin because
we
knew they were going to reunite for that. And Zeppelin's one of the few bands I never did get to see.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, I've seen, you know, pretty much everybody I've wanted to see. I obviously couldn't see the Beatles; they had broken up. But I've seen McCartney, and I saw Ringo's first all-star band tour.
Cool.
Yeah. Which was like incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Stones multiple times. And,
right.
The Who with Keith Moon.
With Keith Moon.
Yeah.
Said. Oh.
Yeah.
And so of the people that you have interviewed, like which one were you most excited about?
Oh, boy. That's like an impossible question to answer.
I know.
Because
you interviewed the guys from The Clash. I mean, for gosh sake.
Oh, yeah. That was special. I was a big proponent of the Rock Hall from the minute they announced it, and I wrote lots of stories, you know, encouraging it and supporting it. People may forget now, but back in the day, it was controversial that Cleveland got the bid to do it. A lot of people thought it belonged elsewhere or that it wouldn't work in Cleveland. So I wrote columns, and then as they were building it, I wrote stories. They gave me an early tour as they were building it, and because of that, they would keep me on top of, like, when they were doing special exhibits and invite me to things. I went to couple of the induction ceremonies, which was, you know, incredible. The year the Bee Gees were invited, it was a strange setup. The performers and everybody were performing in a separate room, and we couldn't be there, the writers. We had to be in a separate room watching it through closed-circuit TV.
Wow.
And then if the people who were inducted wanted to talk to the press, they had the option. They could come upstairs and come into the room and talk and do interviews or whatever.
Okay.
So the year I went, of course, Michael Jackson refused to come up. Prince was there to induct somebody, and he didn't come up. And Neil Young didn't show up because he was mad about not getting free tickets for his whole family or something. Anyway, so at the time it seemed kind of disappointing. But then I remember after the Bee Gees got inducted, you know, the press room door opens up and all three of them come in. The Bee Gees are like standing right in front of me. I'm like, holy.
Wow.
And they were happy and they were smiling and they broke into like a little medley of their songs for, you know, one after the other. I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. You
yeah.
know? So so that was cool. So I got to go to two different induction ceremonies. At the other one, Paul McCartney's there inducting Ringo Starr and Green Day's there, and they're jamming on Beatles songs again. All this is happening right in front of you.
It's yeah, yeah.
The same weekend, Green Day did like a one-off at the House of Blues in Cleveland. You know, small venue for them.
Yeah.
The opening act came out, and I remember I was with my daughter. We're like, who are these guys? Wait a minute. That guy looks like Billy Joe Armstrong. Turns out they opened for themselves. They came out as their original band, what they were before they formed Green Day.
Really?
They had never done that before, so that was That was kind of cool.
Different name?
Yes, different name too. I can't remember now. I'm
sorry. That's all right. Yeah.
But yeah.
Interesting.
That was cool. And so to see all these people like right in front of you.
Yeah.
It's cool. But for the paper, you know, I was for the national interviews, generally anybody who was coming to the arena or the Warner.
Over the phone.
You know, if I had to write a feature, you know. That was, you know, when I came to the paper, that was one of my things. Was like, well, this person's coming to town. Why don't we get them on the phone and try to do? And like, well, you know, go ahead if you want to do that. I would contact. If I remember, if it was Jay back then, whoever who ran the arena.
Oh, okay.
And try to find out the name of the
promoter.
The promoter.
Yeah.
Get a hold of the promoter. They would let me know who the contact person was at the label, whatever. And back then, most major artists would do these.
Yeah,
they would do phoners for most of the cities they would play in, you know. So Aerosmith came to town, I would talk to somebody in Aerosmith. Over the years, you know, everyone from Marilyn Manson to Willie Nelson to Ozzy to... I wrote a list on... Because I didn't want to forget anybody.
You have a long list there. Read some of those off.
This isn't even everybody.
No, I'm sure it's not. Yeah.
Like in no particular order, I wrote down, let's see. Oh, God. Oh, yeah. John Denver, Willie Nelson, Marilyn Manson, Joan Rivers, Red Skelton, Bob Newhart, George Carlin. George Carlin is one of my favorites. He just, he loved to talk.
Yeah.
And it was never canned. You know, sometimes these performers, they say the same thing to everybody on the phone.
Right.
Promoting whatever, and George Carlin was just always, you know, whatever was on his mind, you could talk about.
Chat for a long time.
Yeah. I always tried with the national artists to get something that maybe they didn't tell anybody else.
Right.
I tried to always do my interviews as conversations, not as interviews.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have questions scribbled down, but I would try to get them just talking.
Yeah.
And a lot of times then they'd let their guard down and they would tell you things. Like when I interviewed Katrina and the Waves, remember them?
Absolutely.
She was coming in for a show when their song was big, Walking on Sunshine. And I was like, how are you doing? And she's like, oh, well, I'm okay. I'm just sitting here with my mom. And I said, oh, okay. Well, that's cool. She goes, well, we're actually sort of having a sort of a wake for my sister. I think it was her sister who had just died.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, my God, let's put this off. We'll reschedule
this.
She said, no, the band relies on me for these things. We should do our interview.
Wow.
I'm like, I was just like stunned that she even told me that it happened.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it's always, you know, it was always fun to do.
Yeah.
Just to get people talking. Alice Cooper was another favorite because he loved to talk too, and he never knew what he was going to say.
Yeah. He's a smart dude.
He's a very smart dude.
Yeah.
Kid Rock was insane. You know, he was as you would think he would be. He just said some outrageous things. It was like it was hard to choose like what to leave out with him because he just was pure craziness. It's kind of been borne out by everything he's done since
lately.
Then.
Yeah, right.
But let's see who else here. Roger McGuinn, David Crosby, Graham Nash. Ian Anderson was scary for me because growing in college, I was such a Jethro Tull fan. You know, before the whole new wave thing hit, you know, Thick as a Brick and Aqualung, I loved. So when Jethro Tull came to Erie and I had to interview Ian Anderson, who I always worshipped from afar, just saw as this super intellectual, smart guy, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to ask him something that it's going to piss him off, or he's going to, you know, if he's going to put me in my place. I was really, really worried about that one. But he turned out to be absolutely fine and easy to talk to.
Were there ever any instances where it's, you know, the old saying, don't meet your heroes, where you were disappointed?
There were a lot of times. I can't remember which hip-hop star it was, but I was talking to him, and like 3 or 4 minutes into the interview, he goes, man, fuck this shit, and hung up the phone. That was it, interview
that
over.
Was it.
That was the interview over. I'm like, I don't even know what I said to make him mad, or he just wasn't in the mood to do an interview that day.
So that was a short column that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The shortest one was Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead. I had him on the phone. I said, calling for the interview. He goes, oh, that's right. You know what? Can you give me 5 minutes to call back? And I said, okay. Or he would call back. Anyway, the callback never happened.
Never happened.
So the interview never actually happened. But I did have him on the phone for like a second.
Well, speaking of the interviews that never happened, I mentioned Ozzy in the beginning. You've told the story 100 times, but maybe not everybody on this podcast have heard it. tell the story of the Aussie.
Well, yeah, obviously was coming to the arena for a headlining show, and they scheduled a phone interview for him.
Early 80s, right?
Early 80s, yeah. Right. I think it's the tour where Metallica opened for them.
Right, right, right.
So
it had to be late 80s because he played at the Fieldhouse in like 83 when it closed. So
right, yeah. And I had moved here just after the Fieldhouse days. The arena opened in 83, and I moved here in 84.
Right,
so,
right.
I wish I could have seen some of those shows, like your book pointed out. Right. Unbelievable, the concerts they used to get back then.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another bad thing that's changed, is the way shows get booked these days leaves Erie completely
out of
the lurch now. It used to be Erie, our location helped us, because bands, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Buffalo were right there, so it's like, well, why not play Erie?
Yep.
Now it's the exact opposite. Our location is what prevents us from getting shows.
Yeah.
Because the concert business has become such a mega billion-dollar business now. The way it works is when a major act plays Cleveland, a Live Nation or whoever the promoter is, has them sign a clause that they cannot play an arena within 2, 4, 5 hours of the place.
Right.
And so that means that act can't play Erie.
Right, right.
And because we're between Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Buffalo, we get locked out multiple times.
And a lot of people don't understand that. Right. They just think it's, you know, people don't know how to run the arena or whatever. They don't know what bands to get. But a lot of times we just can't, you know. So we were lucky to get the Elton Johns of the world or the Kenny Chesneys or the, you know, the folks that we have got at the Erie Insurance Arena.
Bob Dylan, remember, played the Warner twice and Conneely Park.
Right.
That was amazing.
Yeah. So Ozzy. So back to Ozzy.
Oh, back,
so it's
back
the late
to
80s.
Ozzy set up to do a phone interview on my day off, but I said, well, I can't pass up. You just go with it. You know, when they schedule these things, I've done a lot of them at home or whatever because you just have to.
Yeah.
So I came in and waited and no call came in. I'm like, well, how long do you wait, you know, for Ozzy Osbourne? I finally just said, screw it. I'm going home. You know, drove home. I can't remember where I was, but the phone rings, and my wife at the time picked up the phone and says, this is Ozzy Osbourne calling for Dave. And she's like, Dave? Ozzy Osbourne says he's...
So someone at the... Yeah. They had given him...
Somebody had apparently had given... Yeah, without me knowing it.
Yeah.
You know, I pick up the phone. Oh, this is Ozzy.
Yeah, could you understand him? Yeah.
It was a little difficult, actually. Sure. He had that accent, but...
Yeah.
I was like, okay. And luckily, I had a computer at home, so I was trying to put him off as long as I could while I ran up there and turned on the computer so I could start taking notes.
Taking notes, yeah. But it worked.
But yeah, it worked. I got the interview in.
Yeah.
And I remember even asking him if the story about eating a bat on stage was true, which I'm sure he didn't want to hear. But
yeah.
He was probably sick of that question.
I'm sure.
But I asked him. But he was, again, perfectly easy to talk to.
He was, okay.
Even believe it or not, Marilyn Manson was easy to talk to. And at the time, this was when Antichrist Superstar had come out and all sorts of controversy and protest. And he sounded tired, you know.
Mm.
But he answered all the questions.
All right.
Some other people.
I'm
trying to think. Oh, this is one funny story. I don't think I told, but you know, back in the day, not only did I do interviews a lot of times, so did Kevin Cuneo, because he wrote Take 30, and a lot of these he would do celebrity interviews as well. So there was one day I was in the office, and this is a memory thing, but my mind has convinced me. I'm pretty sure it was Rob Halford, okay?
Because
Judas Priest was coming here, and I think I was on the phone with Rob Halford, and Kevin's phone is ringing. I'm like, oh, man, no, and he's not there. I'm like, oh, can you hang on? Because, you know, he's my boss.
Kevin. Okay, yeah.
I'm like, I better answer his phone. I pick it up and go, hello, this is Kevin Cuneo's phone. I hear a voice go, hi, this is Liberace calling.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, hey, Lib. Kevin's not here, but can you hang on? Let me see if I can find him. And I go back to Rob Halford.
Yeah.
Can you hang on? I got Liberace on another
phone. Oh, my God. Talk about two ends of the spectrum. Jeez.
So I go running, looking around. Where's Kevin? And I think I did find him, and he interviewed Liberace, because Liberace came to the arena. In the mid-'80s. Yeah.
All right.
Casey Wells always told me that was one of the best shows they ever put on there. I didn't go to that one.
Why? I wonder. Just
he just said he was massively entertaining.
I'm sure he would have been. Yeah, yeah.
Said the crowd absolutely loved it.
I mean, he didn't ride a motorcycle on stage like Rob Halford, but yeah. I mean, That's crazy.
So that was funny. Yeah. Yeah. And then let's see, Kevin Hart, when he came to Erie once, he played the Bayfront Convention Center, like right before he completely blew up
big. Yeah, I was going to say.
Joe Walsh, Dick Clark, the Doors, I mentioned Eric Burdon, Paul Anka.
Would you go to
Garfunkel?
Obviously, you went to a lot of these shows. Not everyone. I didn't see you at the Paul Anka show. Not that I was there, but you know,
I did interview him too, though.
Yeah, but so you didn't always have to go to those shows. Were there any of those shows that you went to then, and you thought, "Oh, this was better than I thought it was going to be"?
Generally, you know, most artists show up. You know, they're there to play,
sure,
and to deliver.
Right.
You know, there's only been a few times I really thought acts were just going through the motions or weren't giving you the best. I don't know if you remember once Three Dog Night played Celebrate Erie, and I thought they were just god awful. They just seemed like they didn't want to be there. In fact, I think they quit like 10 minutes before they were supposed to.
Okay.
They just, you know, so... You know, most artists do give it their all.
Sure.
You know? So I don't remember seeing any show where I thought, oh, my God, this is, you know, this is terrible. I was looking forward to this, but this is terrible.
Yeah,
Not an Erie show. I mean, in you know, an actual concert-going experience, though, I saw when the Cars came out, I loved the Cars, and then I went to see them, and they were just terrible.
You know, it's unbelievable that you say that, because I've probably told the story 100 times of all the concerts I've gone to. The Cars are one of my favorites. I went to see him. Wang Chung opened for him in 84 or whatever, and Wang Chung blew them away. They were so boring. They didn't interact with the crowd. They didn't have that stage presence that I talked about. I literally remember them at Blossom getting out of their limo next to the stage, getting back in, and that was it. You know, I mean... It was so disappointing. It sounded good, but it was boring, you know?
Right. No stage presence or anything. Yeah, they just...
No.
Yeah, same with me. And that time I was in college, and I drove to Chicago to see them, this really long drive. And then the concert was just horribly disappointing.
Yeah.
Another one, the Clash, actually, were somewhat disappointing when I saw them. It was a really hot summer night in the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago, and wall-to-wall people, and... Maybe it was the heat or whatever, but, you know, they just sounded like out of tune, like musically wise. It just was not a very good show.
Sure.
I mean, they were trying, they were doing their best, but just like musically, it was sort of a real disappointment, I remember thinking, you know.
Let's wrap it up with your favorite Erie concert, live event, band experience. Like, what's one of your favorites that you've gone to over the years, and you're like, this is, you know, I'll never forget this show?
Well, Elton John, definitely. It was so special that he
came
to town both times. First time I was like in the third row, so that was awesome to see him that close.
Yeah.
Although I had seen him, he was my first concert ever. You know, I was a big Elton John fan. And as a teenager, somehow, I don't even know how I did it. I talked my mom into taking a train to Chicago so I could see Elton John in the Chicago Stadium, it was at the time. And this was when Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was out.
Nice.
That was my first one. And the second was a couple of years later, Paul McCartney and Wings, because I was like, oh, my God, a Beatle is touring. I got to go, you know. And somehow, I don't know how I got tickets, but I did. It was the Venus and Mars tour.
Oh, great. Yeah.
75. And somebody played Beatles songs. You know, it's one of the, you know. I'll admit it. Sometimes, you know, you see a concert that's so good or emotional, you cry.
Sure.
You just get worked up.
Right.
That's happened with McCartney several times, you know, because it's just the music means so much to me.
Yeah.
And see him live and singing it, and it's awesome.
I've seen him too. Yeah.
Elton John, similar. I saw him in the first row once when he was in college.
Wow.
So, I'm sure there's more. But
how about local bands? Any of that stand out that you...
Obviously, the very last show, Jack Stevenson put on this awesome benefit for me after I retired and invited. He asked me which bands I would like to see play.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, the Bedrocks, but they don't exist anymore. But luckily, Tony said, sure. And he put them back together just to play that show.
That's awesome.
And the Shrugs as well.
Yep.
And Eric Brewer and friends played.
Yeah.
You know, talk about another, you know, endless Erie talent. You know, Eric Brewer is amazing. So that was obviously a memorable gig, and I once had a I think it's for my 25th wedding anniversary at the time. I rented one of the outdoor places there in Erie, those Yerepa Grotto, one of the places. Oh, yeah. It might even have been that one.
Right.
And same thing. I talked like the dogs into playing. Turned out to be their last show ever.
Oh, wow.
The dogs and the Bedrocks and
yeah.
the Blues Beaters and quite a few bands all, all agreed to show up and play.
That's cool.
Yeah. I was like honored that they did that.
Well, everybody in town who's a musician or a music lover is honored that you actually wrote for this town for so many years, and we all thank you. I just want to make sure I say that because I think it should be said. And we're going to show a picture of that giant poster that was of the concert that Jack put together. I always tell people, this podcast is about Erie history. Jack has a podcast that is about the current events, and make sure you check that out at Two Man Happy Hour. What should we wrap it up with, Dave?
Oh, another cool thing that happens when I met Springsteen once. I don't know if I told this story before or not, but do you know Joe Grushecki?
Sure.
He used to be in the Iron City House Rockers.
Right.
So, Joe recorded with Springsteen in the 90s.
Sure.
Springsteen's one of his biggest fans.
Yep.
And usually every time Springsteen plays Pittsburgh, Joe shows up and they play together. Well, Springsteen produced and played on a few of his 90s albums.
Okay.
And then Joe did come to Erie every so often, played as well. So I had interviewed Joe about a new album and that Springsteen was going to be on. And he was doing this release show for it in Pittsburgh at, I'll forget the name of the club now, the Decade or something like
that. Yeah, I can't remember. Decade was one of the clubs.
I'm sorry, it was Nick's Fat City was the name of the club.
Yep.
I got a call from Joe saying, I want you to be a guest at this show. It's a really special one. You should come up. And I'm like, I think I know what this means.
Yeah,
but okay. Right. So I came up, and on my way to try to get to the door, there were like a long line of people who wanted to get in, who didn't have tickets. They were asking you that as you're going, I'll buy your ticket, $100, $300, I'm like, what is going on here? But, three or four songs into the show, he's like, oh, I want to bring out a friend of mine and blah, blah, blah. And out comes Bruce Springsteen to jam with him at his show.
Yeah.
And so he played the whole rest of the night, some of his own songs, mostly Joe's songs. And then they had a meet and greet later that night for Joe after the show was over in the upstairs part of the club. And I'm standing at the bar getting a beer, and I noticed a door back there, and a guy walks in. It's Bruce Springsteen. I'm like, holy shit. So I walked over and said, oh, man, I really enjoyed the show. Nice to meet you. And I shook his hand.
Holy shit.
And then I looked up, and I saw kind of a look of concern in his face. And apparently other people had noticed.
Oh,
he had walked into the room, and all of a sudden you saw
like
a wave of people start trying to get closer. And he must have decided, I don't want to mess with this. So he turned around and went back out that same door.
That door, yeah.
But it was like, well, hey, I got to meet Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, what the heck?
And then a few years after that, they did a bigger show at a small place in Pittsburgh. And again, I got, for that one, I had front row seat. Bruce was as close to me as we are right now, like standing up right in front of me. Yeah, playing this insanely awesome show. Yeah, so yeah, things like that.
Great memories.
Hanging with Spike Lee when he came to town was one of my assignments.
What did he come to town for?
Penn State Barron brought him in
for
something. And so the paper said, go hang out with Spike Lee. They approved it. And I'm like, okay. So, that was cool but terrifying at the same time,
Right.
Because he's such a major figure, Or Dave Barry, the humorist, he used to write the Sunday columns.
Sure.
Humor all the time. Because I know I'm going on too long here.
No, you're not. No, these are great stories. Everybody, these are the stories I like to hear. Yeah.
Well, he wrote for the Miami Herald, but his humor column was syndicated. But when the Marlins were finally awarded a franchise, they had a first field, a minor league team, and Erie got that minor league team. So the Miami Herald thought, well, that's our first pro team for baseball. So let's send Dave to Erie to see what the makings of our minor league team and what it's going to be like.
So
Dave Barry had called up Kevin Cuneo and said, fill me in on Erie. And, he wanted to know as much as he could. He was a terrific reporter as well as being a just, fantastic, funny writer.
I didn't
know
that he was a reporter.
So he flew to Erie, and we met him at one of those sort of divey, I think it was El Patio. We met him at the El Patio. Sure. He was staying there.
Putting him up in the nicest places.
They had a lounge bar there. Yeah. So we met him in there. And
Choo-choos.
And then he stayed the entire week, and he would come up into the press box occasionally, because I was there back then still doing sports.
Right.
Remember, back then I covered the Browns and occasionally Seawolves games.
Right.
Anyway, so hung out with Dave Barry, and then he got to know that I was also Dr. Rock. And he just thought it was hilarious that, well, he goes, you not only write sports, but then you're Dr. Rock? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, okay. And so Dave hung out with Dave like the whole kind of week, and Kevin did. And then when he was getting ready to leave Erie, a bunch of us from the paper met him at the Plymouth. And Dave said, I'm going to pick up the tab. And they gave him the bill. And he looked at it, and he's like, this must be some mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
He couldn't believe it was so cheap.
How cheap it was, yeah.
Blew his mind. So a month or two later, when his piece ran, it ran as a Sunday magazine piece, a real long piece about, you know, everything in it was absolutely true. But I was stunned to see that I was in the story, and so was my picture.
Oh.
You know what I mean? And he sent me, like, a really nice copy of it and, you know, that's signed cool. it and said, hey, this is for you. And
yeah.
And then that same story was later picked up for a compilation that they put together every year, the best sports stories of the year.
Really?
So Dave Barry's story was in that. Because like an idiot, I lost what he sent me. But I later found a copy of that book, and I bought the book. So
that's very cool.
So, yeah, opportunities like that are...
Were there other weird opportunities like that where your sports and rock life intertwined? I can't see...
Yeah, I 1 year, you know, because... You know, way back then, our circulation was strong, and because we were located between Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and Cleveland, we got the rights to cover, you know, all the NFL games and Super Bowls and major sporting events. Well, usually Kevin Cuneo or Jim Camp, who was the morning news editor, they took turns every year who would go to the Super Bowl. No matter who was in the Super Bowl, we always got a credential, and off they would go. 1 year, Kevin couldn't go. And Jim Camp didn't want to go, so they said, Dave, you want to cover the Super Bowl? I'm like,
yes.
Yeah. They're like, okay, so this was the year when it was Elway playing against Green Bay Packers at Favre.
Okay. Yeah.
Elway was gunning for his first Super Bowl. The Packers were hoping to repeat because they had won it the previous year. So, what a matchup.
Yeah, absolutely, you know?
But also, what an assignment because... Back then, we were still two papers, a morning and an evening. So I had to write, you know, they wanted like front page, kind of non-sports, but like, you know, puffy, you're there on the scene.
Sure, right.
For the morning news and the evening paper. But they had to be different, you know, because they're two different papers.
Oh, right.
And then they wanted a notes column for both papers and then like another story. So I was writing like six stories a day.
Yeah.
And trying to send them. And I remember when I flew into San Diego, of course, around a different time. The morning news deadline was like roughly like 10 or 9 or 10 at night. You know, I got there and literally had like an hour to write my first story for the front page.
And you probably didn't have a laptop.
And I just, we did. We had these old Radio Shack Tandy things.
Oh, did you?
Okay. Were terrible. You could only read like six lines at a time as you typed it.
It probably weighed a ton.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And that was the dial-up days.
Oh, right.
The,
yeah.
Oh, my God. That's a whole nother story.
Yeah. You're worried, did it go through?
But I rushed to the, took the cab straight to the convention center in San Diego, which was the Super Bowl headquarters. Looking around, like, I've got to find somebody to talk to and bang out a story here. And, you know, and I saw Joan Embry. Do you remember that name?
Sure, yeah.
She used to be on the San Diego Zoo emissary. Right. She was always on the Tonight Show. Anyway, she walked by. I was like, Joan, tell me about the San Diego Zoo or something.
Oh, my God.
Anyways, I just... And then I had to file it super fast, and boom, you know. But that one, you know, the game was terrific, but then, of course, the music fan in me is like, oh, what's the halftime show?
Oh, yeah.
And it turned out to be a 40th anniversary salute to Motown. So the Temptations were there, and Stevie Wonder. I was Stevie there?
Oh, wow.
No, Smokey Robinson was there. So, all these, you know. I'm supposed to be sitting there, like, trying to like put my notes together, get things ready, but I'm also looking out,
checking
out the halftime show.
Yeah, I'm sure you got to see a few different halftime shows.
And then they put me up in a hotel, and the first night I was trying to sleep. I couldn't sleep because all this banging and stuff is going on outside my window. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? Boom, banging, banging, banging. So when I got up the next morning and looked, they had built a stage right down there. And I had a balcony on my room. And that night, I'm sitting on my balcony after I was finally done, looking down there, and out come the Neville Brothers performing on that stage.
Wow.
San Diego had decided they were going to set up multiple stages throughout the whole downtown area for the Super Bowl week.
Wow.
And so... because I had a balcony, I was like, every night concert. I was like sitting there listening to different bands going, oh my God, I got private concert here, you know? I remember walking through it and I was like, is that Blister in the Sun? I swear I blistered. And sure enough, there was the Violent Femmes playing.
Really?
At one stage, the Blasters were playing at another stage. So again, the music and the sports went together.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was like, what a great time to be down there. Even the restaurant I went to was called Time in a Bottle, T-H-Y-M-E, Time in a Bottle, because it was owned by Jim Croce's widow.
Right.
And because she had set up in San Diego, and they had his gold records and all these things posted all over the place.
Yeah.
So.
Did you meet her, too?
I did not.
No.
I don't even know if she was there.
But, yeah.
So.
Very cool.
And God, Rock Hall events, like I said, I could go on. There was a night where Little Richard and Ike Turner and guys were all jamming together. It was like one of these private events.
Like after the main...
Well, it was just... it was like celebrate the opening of something, but it was only open to journalists.
Oh,
and for our entertainment, we have some entertainment, and out comes Little Richard. I'm like, he kept saying, you make me scream like a white woman. During his show. And then when the Rock Hall opened in 95, do you remember that? They put on a huge concert to celebrate the whole history of rock and roll.
Right.
And Chuck Berry was there, and Aretha, and Little, and Jerry Lee Lewis. And I mean, it was the last show the Kinks ever played. They were there. It was amazing.
And you were there.
I was not only there, they gave me like a private box, because at the Brown Stadium, they have, you know, these boxes all the way around the top. And I saw that this was where my ticket was for, so I went in there, and then waiting for like 12 other people to show up. And nobody ever did, so I was just in this private little box myself watching, you know, the Pretenders and Kinks. And
before cell phone cameras and everything, you just had to take it in and remember it.
That's right. It was 95.
Yeah,
before all that stuff. So
holy cow. Great.
Anyway, I know I'm spilling all my memories here, but why not?
You know? Absolutely. Why not? Yeah.
Thanks. They'll all be in my book someday.
Are you going to write a book?
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I'm trying, but.
We talked earlier. You're in your mid-60s. You're in great shape. You look great.
Oh, thank you.
You haven't been writing professionally since 2018, right?
Since, 18 or 19. I can't remember when I stopped. It might have been 19. I think I freelanced 3 years.
But what's Dr. Rock up to these days? What have you been doing?
Just enjoying being retired, you know?
Enjoying retired?
Yeah, I don't know. Some people seem to think retirement's like a dirty word these days, that you always have to work or be doing something. And I say, no. I say, no. I did that for 31 and a half years at the paper full-time, and then 3 freelancing. Of course, I worked at that other paper before then. And and also, you know, as much as I loved my job at the paper, it was also very, very stressful and demanding.
Oh, I bet.
And last 4 or 5 years, I worked overtime every week. I was really, really burned out.
Yeah.
So it was... You know, the paper was sold. That's why that's what spurred the early exit. Had that not happened, you know, if the Mead still owned the paper, I might still be there.
Yeah.
I mean, I did enjoy doing it. You know, we were real proud of Showcase.
Absolutely.
It was like 32 pages usually every week. By the time I retired, 28 to 32 pages. And we were always trying to make it all local. It was always about local events. It wasn't national things. It was things happening in Erie, but times change.
Absolutely.
Including the times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I said it earlier. We appreciate it. We thank you. Thanks for telling me all these stories. This is great. And these days, if you're looking for Dr. Rock, you might just see him out and about at some of the bars, and because I know I still see pictures with you and Jack Stevenson, because Jack takes pictures of everybody.
And Jack goes everywhere.
And Jack knows everyone and goes everywhere. So
he does.
But that also means you still go see live music today.
I do. And also thanks to Jack for doing the two-man happy hour. I'm absolutely so glad somebody picked up on that and lets people know who's playing where and
right.
when.
You right.
know, that's really important to have.
All right. Well, I thanked you, and we're thanking Jack, and we thank everybody for listening. So we'll wrap it up there. Sound good?
Sounds good. Thanks again.
All right, man. Thanks. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Erie Music History Podcast. I want to say thanks to the JPT Foundation. They have been a financial supporter of the podcast since the beginning, and they also will give us a free space to have our monthly music night on the first Tuesday of the month. It always features our great house band, the Fabulous Leftovers, as well as a lot of other local bands and musicians. Sometimes it's a basic open mic after that, but it's a lot of fun. First Tuesday of the month, totally free. Any donations go to the Second Harvest Food Bank. It is BYOB. You can bring in alcohol, drinks, whatever you'd like. There's a great pizza shop next door, Pasalinquas. There's a Subway in the plaza, so check that out. The first Tuesday of the month. Aside from the JPT Foundation, I want to thank Angelo Phillips, who has been a financial supporter of the podcast for the past couple months. Angelo is a great local musician who I will be happy to play with. Next year, we're going to play a few gigs together, so looking forward to that. Also, make sure that you check out Jack Stevenson's Two Man Happy Hour podcast. Basically tells you where people are playing today. Where and when, and you can check that out at the number2manhappyhour.com. Check that out. He also does a weekly podcast with our sound man for the monthly music night, Brian Waller, as well as Nat the Hat. So the three of them do a great podcast where they interview local musicians, and they again talk about who is playing where. But more importantly, they play a lot of local music on that. So check that out. That's Music Chat with Nat the Hat. And you can find that on Facebook anywhere. All right. That's all I got for you. Thanks again for listening.